Today we'll talk about the electrons in a periodic lattice. In condensed matter, we study a lot of solids which are crystalline. And electrons are moving in the background of some periodic lattice made by atoms or ions or whatever. And there's an astonishing variety of phases of electronic matter that arises. You have insulators, you have semiconductors, carbon or silicon or germanium. You have lots of different metals. You have superconductors. You have magnets. So all kinds of states can arise from that. And it turns out that many of these states can be understood by a model that is fairly simple. It's a model of electrons that are moving in a periodic lattice, and they do not interact much with one another. So for today and for part of the next week, we'll adopt the approximation of non-interacting electrons. This might sound strange because electrons do interact. After all, they're charged particles, and so they repel each other. But it turns out that this approximation at least provides a good start. And once you understand how independent electrons live in a periodic lattice, you can also turn on interactions and see whether you can take them into account in some fashion. And mostly it's taken into account as some sort of a background provided by other electrons for this electron. Okay? So other electrons are merely going on their ways and provide some potential for the other for the remaining electron. The atoms and ions are also not sitting still, and they're moving around in principle. So it looks like a complicated problem. But fortunately, the timescales on which the atomic lattice is moving and timescales on which electrons are living, they're fairly different. And the difference comes from the difference in their masses. Right? Atoms are much, much heavier than electrons. Even the lightest atom, hydrogen, would be 1,800 times as heavy as an electron. And so there's hope that this separation of timescales allows you to treat the lattice as frozen on the timescales relevant to electrons. And so that's what we'll do. That's not entirely accurate, and there are certain phenomena in which the dynamics of the lattice is important for electrons. In particular, superconductivity in many of the superconductors has to do with the reaction of the lattice to the presence of the electrons. But we have to start somewhere. And so we'll assume that there is an idealized, highly periodic lattice such as this one, highly regular, and electrons are moving in that lattice. So we'll cover the following topics today. We'll start with the discussion of electrons in a periodic potential in one spatial dimension, discover how energy gaps form in such a structure, and then go on to higher dimensions and discuss the systematics of what we call the reciprocal lattice. Find to draw a symmetric Brillouin zone and to deduce various things from that. So let me start with a well-defined problem. A single electron in a periodic potential in one dimension. So U of x doesn't change if you shift it by the lattice period A. So you can write down the Schrödinger equation where the Hamiltonian is kinetic energy of the electron p squared over 2m plus this potential. So P is the operator minus I h bar d dx. If you didn't have the periodic potential, then we can use plane waves as eigenstates of energy. So psi of x would be something like e to I kx. And then the energy of that state would be h bar squared k squared over 2m. So now we want to see what happens if you turn on this periodic potential. And it's a good idea to write a periodic potential as a sum of sine waves with periods a over 2, and so on. So you can write it as a Fourier series with some amplitudes lambda n times e to I n bx, where b is 2 pi divided by the latest period a. N is an integer, and lambda n are complex coefficients that satisfy this, right? So that the potential would be a real function. So if you think about a weak potential, then you can start with plane waves as a zeroth order approximation, and then see what happens when you include the periodic potential. Right? If you start with the wave function with the state k, then if you act with this potential energy as the perturbation on the state with some given momentum, then you're going to obtain states with other momenta. So sum over lambda n coefficients times k plus nb, right? So you take a plane wave, you multiply it by this factor, you shift the momentum by n times b. And so you can see that momentum is no longer conserved. It can shift by b, by minus b, by 2b, by minus 2b, any integer number of b's. So if I draw my kx's here, so let's say this is 0, and then if I have some momentum k, a particle starting with this state might find itself shifted in momentum space. So from here, it might be scattered to here, or it may be scattered in the opposite direction. And so momentum is no longer well defined. That's because the translational symmetry is broken, right? The presence of a periodic potential makes space no longer uniform. But even though this translational symmetry is broken, it's not entirely broken, because there are some translations that still are symmetries, right? These are translations by one layer of spacing, by A, by 2A, 3A, and so on. And so it means that something still remains of this momentum. And what remains is its position within a single Brillouin zone, a portion of the k-space of length b, right? So for instance, this momentum and that momentum are clearly distinct, because you cannot scatter from here to here by using one of these numbers, b or 2b or 10b, right? So these are still distinct. They're not equivalent in any sense. These are equivalent, but these are not. So you can still have a playground, a sandbox, essentially, in k-space, where you can say that momentum is conserved. It's not conserved because you can be moved out of this sandbox into the next one. But within the sandbox, you're OK. So in other words, momentum is conserved modulo b. And so for that reason, we are going to stick to a single sandbox. We're not going to consider outside sandboxes. So we just have to make do with one of them. So the energy dispersion is like this for the moment. And if I just operate within, let's say, the sandbox between minus b over 2 and plus b over 2, I like this choice better because it's more symmetric, right? So if I just work from 0 to b, I have momenta positive but not negative. Here I have both positive and negative momenta. So if I look at the dispersion, this is what it looks like. So if I stick with just this sandbox, it seems like I can only describe states with fairly low energies, and I cannot go to higher energies. How do I get the higher momentum, higher energy states? Well, I know that momenta over here are the same as momenta over there. So I can take this dispersion that's coming up still, and I can shift it by minus b, right? And so I will have it coming from this point and going up like this. And it'll keep going up. And so in fact, I should draw this as a solid line. And there will be another one that kept going this way, and so we'll shift it by plus b, and we'll have another line intersecting this one coming up to here. So let me label these, because now for each value of momentum k, I have several values of energy, not one, but many, right? So I cannot just use the label k anymore. I have to use some additional label n that will tell me which state I am talking about.
Could you repeat the assignment? I didn't understand exactly why you have that.
So if I just use the dispersion h bar squared k squared over 2m, within the sandbox, I will obtain only low energy states.
Right.
How do I get the high energy states?
Oh, you mean like for, if you go like to higher k, you just reflect back onto this
region? I'm not reflecting back. I'm saying that these states here, although they have momentum greater than b over 2, they can be shifted in momentum by minus b, and they will end up on this side. And so this curve is mimicked by that one. Not by this one, not by the reflected one, but by the translated one. Okay. So I've got these two branches, and I will label these branches by the number of, by the wave vector by which they were shifted. Okay. So the original central branch at low energies will have index 0 because it's not shifted at all. This one was shifted by plus b from here, so this is going to be the plus 1 branch, and this is still the plus 1 branch, and this would be the minus 1 branch. Right? And then as I get up to here, I need to include further branches, so there will be a branch coming up from that side. This would be the plus 2 branch, and there will be a minus 2 branch coming up from there. Okay? And I can keep going up.
So the state that you labeled by k and n is the eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian?
No, no, no. For now, these are just eigenstates of the kinetic energy. I have not yet included my scattering, right? So I will include the potential energy, and then we'll see what happens.
Why did we kind of shift like little parts of it instead of just the whole?
It's not parts. I'm shifting the entire curves. In fact, if I, right, so let's say this goes down like that. So it has a bottom at B. So I just say, in other words, I can say, well, these momenta with their curves are as good as those momenta. And so I can shift this curve to the right. Right? And this will be this parabola that happens to come that way. Okay? So right now it's just some relabeling, because in fact there's no scattering yet. So it's just a pretext to move the bands by plus b or minus b or plus 2b or minus 2b. Right? But there's no scattering yet. But once we turn on the scattering, this would be real.
I also didn't get why is that restriction for you corresponds to a weak potential? Like, you're basically just kicking your electron into a higher or lower energy state.
No. So it's not scattering into higher or lower energy states. It's changing its momentum, right? If I apply, right, if I start with the wave function that was psi k of x, which was e to I kx, I apply the perturbation to the state, right? So psi k of x, I will end up with a sum of k plus nb times x, right? So the action of the potential energy onto these states is to shift the momentum, right? So in other words, if I write this as u times k, this would be a sum over n, lambda n times k plus n times b. And here I'm still using the old momentum designation, pretending that momentum is conserved, right? And so this means that there will be a matrix element connecting states k and k plus nb. And this matrix element is equal to lambda n, right? So states with momenta k and k plus nb are now connected by scattering. So all of this is based on these considerations. So now let me imagine a situation when lambda is small or the potential is weak. Right? So lambda or lambda n's are going to zero. They're not exactly zero, but they're close to zero. And if perturbations are weak, then I'm going to have a small effect from them. So let me do the following. I'm going to consider a specific value of momentum k. Right? So I'll be sitting, for instance, over here or maybe over there. So this will be my k, and as I go up, I encounter these various energy levels. Right, so there'll be an energy level with a very low energy, and then an energy level with a higher energy, and so on. Right, so there'll be levels or states k0, k1, etc. I can write down the Hamiltonian matrix within this subspace. So I'm not including other momenta. I'm just working with this momentum and its twins shifted by plus b minus b and so on. Right? So let's see what the matrix will look like in that case. So it's k and n, or you can say k plus nb. You'll have a matrix for the Hamiltonian that looks like this. So there'll be something on the diagonal. And on the diagonal at the center, you will have h bar squared k squared divided by 2m. And then next to it, you will have h bar squared k plus b squared divided by 2m. And just above it and to the left, you will have h bar squared k minus nb squared divided by 2m. Right. These are the diagonal matrix elements, just the kinetic energy. Right. Off the diagonals, you will have the lambda coefficients just as we deduced here, right? So it'll be lambda minus 1 here, lambda 1 here. And remember that they're complex conjugates of each other. So this is a Hermitian matrix. So likewise here, it'll be lambda minus 1 and lambda 1 and so on. Lambda 2 will be, or minus 2 would be here. Lambda 2 would be there. Lambda 2 and so on. So there'll be a matrix of this sort. It'll be completely filled with numbers. Some of the lambdas might be absent if some specific harmonics are absent. But generally, this will be a large matrix because I have, in principle, infinitely many harmonics. This is what makes it complicated, right? So you have a problem with many interacting levels. But as you know, perturbation theory makes things easier, right? So if the perturbation is weak, then we can probably say something about it. Right? So in this picture, if I choose K in this way, the weakness of the perturbation is compared to what? To the splitting between the levels, right? So here there are pretty big gaps between consecutive energy levels. So if lambda is small compared to these gaps, then it's not going to make much of a difference. There will be no correction to the first order. There'll be a correction to the second order, to these energy levels, right? So it'll be shifted a little bit. Which way will the ground state shift? Second order perturbation theory? It goes down always, right? Yeah, so the ground state will come down a little bit, and then the next levels, it all depends, right? So it looks like there's not much happening for this generic K number, but there will be some wave numbers for which there will be interesting consequences. Which ones are those?
The boundaries.
At the edges, right? So right here we have a degenerate case. We have two states with the exact same energy. So no matter how weak the perturbation is, it's going to split them. And at the center, again, we also see an intersection. So again, there will be an intersection over there. So if I do this at those special points, and then the change will be as follows. So I will have to erase a little bit here. And I will uncover this. Right? So for a weak perturbation, I'll have the influence just within a small window, right? So right at the edge, they're going to split by how much? What's the splitting going to be? The matrix elements are lambda 1 and lambda minus 1. What's the splitting? It's twice the absolute value of lambda 1, right? Because if you do the degenerate perturbation theory, so I'll come back to that. So there'll be a similar splitting on this side, because basically this point is the same as that point. Right. There will be a splitting here. Right, and this splitting will be one band is shifted by plus 1, the other by minus 1, or let me say plus b and minus b. And here it's plus b and minus b, minus 2b and plus 2b, okay? So this splitting would be by lambda 2 twice, because they're connected by 2b. So it's a minor change. It's limited to some points, but it's actually sometimes extremely important. Because what we discover now is that the spectrum of energies, as you explore it going from up to down or from down to up, it will feature gaps. Right? So there is, starting from zero, there's always some energy level until you hit this point. And then there's a break. There are no states with these energies. And then again, there are allowed values of energy, and then again, a forbidden gap. So the scattering, no matter how weak, is going to produce at some special points, in this case, the center and the edge of the Brillouin zone, it's going to produce energy gaps. So why are these gaps might be important? You have to think about what happens when you start filling these energy levels with electrons, right? So suppose we start filling this lower band, and we only fill it up to here, up to the middle. Then you have occupied levels up to here, and then you have empty levels right next to them. So if you'd like to make an excitation out of this state, which we call the Fermi C, which is filled just up to this level, you can just take a particle right next to the edge of the C and move it to an unoccupied state just above that edge. And so it means that you can make excitations with arbitrarily low energies. This is characteristic of metals. In the metal, you can easily accelerate electrons because you have states with excitations with low energies readily available. So you can put an electron into a state with a slightly higher momentum, accelerating it. But if you now fill it up to here, then you will not have any energy levels available to you for small excitation energies, right? So you would have to move an electron from here to here, paying a finite energy. And at low temperatures, compared to the value of this energy gap, there will be no such excitations. And so at lower temperatures, you will not have a metal here. You will have an insulator or a semiconductor at the intermediate temperatures. That's why these gaps are important. And that's why we pay so much attention to them. Okay? So this is the picture in one dimension. And in order to prepare you for what happens next in higher dimensions, let me recapitulate some terms here, some notions. Okay? So we have the original physical lattice, or the direct lattice of atoms. And this lattice has its period. And this period is A. The wave numbers by which you scatter electrons were, we can write them as n times b, where b is 2 pi divided by a. Right, so these are the wave numbers of the Fourier amplitudes of our potential energy, right, which was defined over there. So lambda n are coefficients of waves with these wave numbers, n times b. They also form a lattice. Right, so this would be 0, this would be minus b, this would be b, 2b, and so on. All right, so b is the period of the reciprocal lattice. Reciprocal refers to the fact that length is, the lattice constant of the original lattice is measured in meters. This one is measured in inverse meters, right, as its inverse length or wave number. So the product of the periods of the direct and reciprocal lattice, A times B, is equal to 2 pi. So this is how things are in one spatial dimension. It's easy and simple enough to figure out. So I believe in the tutorial you'll solve some problems related to this in particular. On Monday, not today.
On Monday, according to Penny Morton.
That's right. Good. Okay, so let's go to higher dimensions. We can generalize this to higher dimensions. We'll do so for two dimensions. And once you understand how things are done in two dimensions, you can do it in any number of dimensions. It will be similar to this. So we'll consider, again, a periodic lattice such as this one. This is known as the hexagonal lattice, and sometimes people call it the triangular lattice. Hexagonal refers to the fact that there are six neighbors here, so you make six-fold rotations. They're your symmetry. So here you can shift, let's say, along this direction, and the lattice looks the same. You can also shift in this direction, or in this direction, or in that direction, and so on. There are six directions in which you can shift, and it still looks the same. But these six displacements are not linearly independent of each other. In fact, since we're in two dimensions, it suffices to provide just two periods, this one, let's say, and that one. Or you can use this one and this one, for instance. The choice is yours. So what characterizes this is you have periodicity that is slightly more complicated than previously. You have two periods now. U of r plus a1 is the same as u of r. And it doesn't change if you shift by a2. In fact, it doesn't change if you shift by any period a that is superposition of a1 and a2 with integer coefficients. So if it's a periodic structure, you can presumably also represent it in terms of some Fourier series, right? So you can just use some waves. Like in one dimension, we could expand any periodic potential as a sum of cosines or sines. In this case, we can do the same thing. But now these will be waves going in all kinds of directions. So it'll be a sum of our wave numbers, B, that I will have to figure out. So it'll be coefficients lambda B times e to I B dot R. So B will be some wave numbers that I don't know yet. We'll have to figure them out. And the only restriction that we need to put here is that lambda B star would be the same as lambda minus B. That will ensure that this potential is a real function. Okay. If you do a continuum Fourier transform, so and calculate U tilde of K, this would be the integral of U of R e to minus I K dot R. D to R in this case, that would be, once you write it in this form, you'll be taking the integral of e to minus ik dot r times e to I b dot r. So I can write it as a sum over these special wave vectors, then integral lambda b e to I b dot r minus I k dot r d to r. So what's the result of this integration? A delta function, right? So if these wave numbers are not the same, then the integrand oscillates, you get nothing. And if they're equal, it gives you an infinite result because you're integrating over the entire space. So that would be the sum over these numbers b. 2 pi squared times delta function of k minus b. So if you times lambda b. So it's a superposition of delta functions in k space, aka the reciprocal space, with amplitudes lambda. Right, so you can picture a two-dimensional plane. And then the third axis is the amplitude. And so you'll have some peaks, discrete peaks and nothing in between. So in fact, this can even be measured experimentally if you perform some kind of a diffraction experiment. X-ray scattering, electron scattering, neutron scattering, all these provide a possibility to measure actually not lambda themselves, but lambda absolute value squared. You will get peaks in a diffraction pattern if you scatter your waves off a perfect crystal. So we need to figure out where these Bs are located. And to do that, I'll use the following trick. I'm going to take this picture, and I'm going to draw some lines through these points. So this is my physical lattice. And so it looks like there are points that are on the same line. So these are all on the same parallel lines. If I think about these lines as wave fronts, that is positions where the phase is the same, it'll be a wave traveling in which direction? So this way or that way, right? So let's say it's traveling that way. And it'll have some wave number, or wave vector b, that I need to determine, right? Well, since this is the wavelength, I can tell what lambda is. So in this case, lambda would be, I can take a triangle. If this side is a, then this height would be a times root 3 over 2. And so then the magnitude of b would be 2 pi divided by 4 pi divided by a root 3. And it has a direction. And so this direction is going to be root 3 over 2. 1/2. Okay, so I'll call this vector B1. Right, it goes at 60 degrees to the vertical, or 30 degrees to the horizontal. So it has a higher cosine than sine. OK. So it's a wave. It's not the only wave that's present here, because if this were the only wave, then we would have a uniform state along these lines, right? So imagine that this is a density wave. You have a high density here, low density there, high density here, low density there. Right? So it's modulated like this. So clearly, it's not enough to have just a wave going in this direction. Which other directions do you think we would need? How about the vertical direction? So we can take a wave with wavefronts that are horizontal. And we can again make a calculation. So this would be another vector. Let's call it B2. It will have the same magnitude of the wave number because the distance is still between the wave fronts is a root 3 over 2. And the magnitude of b is 4 pi divided by a root 3. But the direction is 0, 1. Okay. Any other directions? So we can move in that direction, right? And that will be another one. So that's B3. 4 pi a root 3 times. So it's the same as the first one, except it's moving. So its x component will have the opposite sign, minus root 3 over 2, 1/2. Something like that, right? So in fact, with these three waves, we can get a pretty good caricature or lattice. So there will be maxima where all three intersect, and so these will be our lattice points where the potential is the highest, and then in between there would be minima or something like that. But we presumably will have to add higher harmonics of these, right, because the potentials are, they may be concentrated here, so you need higher harmonics, and so on. Notice that actually this wave vector can be constructed out of these two. If you add B1 and B2, then root 3 and minus root 3 cancel out. And half add up to 1. So B2 actually is the sum of B1 and B3. So they're not linearly independent. In fact, we just need two of these numbers, two of these vectors, to construct the rest of them. Right? And so here's my lattice of vectors B. So I start with, this would be 0. And then if I add B2, I'm going upward. So that would be my vector B2. And if I add vector B1, I'm going this way. So I'll make an equilateral triangle here. And then I can apply these B2 and B1 to generate the rest of the lattice. So I can add, for instance, to this one, minus B2, and I'll end up here. And so this would be my lattice. And so on. What kind of a lattice is this? It's another hexagonal lattice, except it's rotated 90 degrees or 30 degrees, whichever you like. Okay, so the period of this lattice, the magnitude is this, and right, so it's 4 pi over a root 3, and we'll get back to that fact. Questions? Great. So one thing you should actually notice here is that there's an interesting relation between vectors B and vectors A. In this particular case, A1 is perpendicular to B2. Right? So A1 points horizontally, B2 points vertically. And A2 points this way, and B1 points that way. They're also orthogonal. In fact, if you multiply these vectors, you'll find the following relation. AI dot BJ is equal to 2 pi times the Kronecker delta. So you can check, for instance, with B2 and A2. B2 is this. You multiply it on A2. So you just need to multiply the y components, right? So the y component there is root 3 over 2. Multiply by this. Cancel root 3, 4 pi divided by 2. Right? That's 2 pi. So you get this. In fact, you can always make this choice. So it's always possible to select your basis in the reciprocal space in this way. So in fact, it's, you know, you don't need to draw anything. You can just say, I know what my basis vectors are for the direct lattice. Let's just define the B vectors through this relation. And you'll find them, and they'll be precisely what you need. We can also look at the volumes of unit cells in direct and reciprocal space. Right? In one dimension, the volume of the unit cell is A. The volume of the unit cell in reciprocal space is B, and their product is 2 pi. So in two dimensions, we'll define them as follows. So the volume of a unit cell in this space, what's the unit cell here? What does it look like? No. It's a rhombus, right? So this is one unit cell. Okay? Because if you just have one triangle, it's not a unit cell, because you can only shift this triangle in such a way that it'll become another up triangle. And the down triangles will not be covered. So you need to cover the entire plane using these cells and the translations. So a rhombus will be your unit cell in this case. And the volume of the unit cell is going to be the vector product of these two, right? A1 cross A2, take the absolute value. We calculate this. We have both vectors of length A, and the sine of the angle between them is root 3 over 2. So this is direct space. In reciprocal space, you do the same thing with vectors b1 and b2. So they have length 4 pi over a root 3 each. So you get 16 pi squared over a squared times 3 times root 3 over 2. So that's going to be 8 pi squared divided by root 3 a squared. You take their product. What do you get? 2 pi squared. So this is something you can always use to check that, you know, what you've built is consistent. So we can generalize this to an arbitrary number of dimensions. So the scalar product of the basis vectors of the direct and reciprocal space is again going to be the Kronecker delta. The volume of the unit cell so V would be, how would you define the volume of a unit cell in three dimensions? What would it be? The triple product. And in higher dimensions, what would it be? The wedge product. So it's A1 wedge A2 AD. And V tilde would be the same with the B vectors. And the product, of course, would be 2 pi to the power D. So see, higher dimensions are easy. Once you understand two dimensions, then everything works in analogy with that. Any questions? Well, let's get back to two dimensions and think about unit cells again in reciprocal space. Why is it important for me to think about a unit cell in reciprocal space? Well, in reciprocal space, it would be this one. Let's say this is 0, and then I'm looking at this unit cell. Why am I looking at this unit cell? Corresponds to what?
To that
Exactly, right? So this is where my independent momenta live. If I take a momentum over here, I can just use vector b1 to represent it by one of these momenta. Right? So all of the momenta are now represented by the momenta within this unit cell. What's the problem with this unit cell? It's ugly, right? So it has momenta going way up there, but not in this direction. I want to make it more beautiful. How do I do that? I would love to see that on the lattice.
Surgery.
A surgery, yes. How about some therapy? Okay, so this is what we're going to do. A similar construction, by the way, can be made in the direct lattice, right? So instead of using this unit cell, we could use something more beautiful, which will look like what? A hexagon, right? So the idea is you take, so let me draw it here. You take the vicinity of a zero wave number. So this is my zero. And then I have adjacent reciprocal lattice vectors, the b's. Right. So I'm going to draw the b vectors or the lines to the nearest b vectors, like this. And next, I'm going to intersect them, or to bisect them, right in the middle, right? So I take this line, and I bisect it. I draw a line that cuts it in half. And I do the same thing for this line. So the middle is right here. So it's going to be like this. And I do it for this line. And I do get a hexagon, right? What is the meaning of this construction? How would you describe this construction? What am I looking for?
The points which are nearest to the
origin. Exactly. I'm looking for the points that are nearest to this point of the reciprocal lattice. Right? So this point is closer to this than to that. And so if I do this, then the entire lattice, not just the central hexagon, can be partitioned into hexagons. And points within each hexagon will be closest to its center. Right, so each point will be accounted for. It's guaranteed. Okay, so this is our beautiful symmetric first Brillouin zone. You can have further Brillouin zones, which would be kind of like this. Right, so they will be surrounding the other reciprocal lattice points. So this one was not symmetric enough. It's over here, right? And so on. And so you could, in principle, pick any of these hexagons and use it to represent all the points in K-space. But the most natural choice, of course, would be the central one. Well, what's the size of this hexagon? How would you determine the size of this hexagon? The volume must be the same as the volume of that unit cell, right? So we can figure out where this point is. So this point, let's call it K, capital. We'll have coordinates K capital and 0 because it's right on the x-axis. And we know that the volume of this hexagon has to be, what did we calculate it to be? 8 pi squared over a squared root 3, was it? Just look it up in your notes if you have them. Okay, good. So this is 6 volumes of individual triangles, right? So you can split the hexagon into 6 triangles like that. And each triangle has the size equal to k, right? That distance is k, and these are equilateral triangles times 1/2 k squared times root 3 over 2, which is the sine of 60 degrees. Right, so from that, k squared is going to be 8 pi squared divided by a squared. Upstairs we have a factor of 4, and downstairs we have a factor of 3, is it? Actually, no. So it's 6 times 3. Something like that. Right. So it'll be 16 pi squared divided by 9a squared. So our k is going to be 4 pi over 3a is 0. So that's this point. So we have a hexagon with how many vertices? How many vertices are there? I'm serious.
Six.
And how many edges? Someone said 2 vertices. That's the right answer. Why 2? Well, because some of these points are related by a reciprocal lattice vector. Or you can say, you know, if you draw this as a circle rather than a point, how much of this circle is inside the hexagon? 1/3. Where are the other 2/3? One is here, and the other is there. So you have to only take 1/3 of this, 1/3 of this, and 1/3 of this, and you get 1 vertex. This is why I was saying the edge and not the edges in the one-dimensional case. Remember that? Okay. And so then there is a second vertex, which is here. So this is denoted k prime, and it has one of the representations would be that it's just minus k, right? Or you can say it's here. So these are 2 distinct points in k-space. And so you have 2 vertices, and you have 3 edges, right? These 2 edges are the same. These 2 edges are the same. So in fact, these 2 edges are related by this reciprocal lattice vector. Right? So this is a reciprocal lattice vector, and so is this. And that's why you only have 3 edges and not 6. Half an edge from each. So having understood all this and having constructed this beautiful symmetric reciprocal lattice unit cell, tell me, when I switch on the scattering, where will the parabolic energy momentum dispersion get warped? Well, so imagine that I have this hexagon and now I'm drawing a parabolic rotational surface toward you. So it'll be extending like this. Scattering will affect some states, right? The ones which are connected by a reciprocal lattice vector. Where are those states? Where are those momenta? At the edges. Right? So along the edges, a state like this and a state like that, they're connected by scattering. And therefore, and they will be degenerate because they have equal and opposite momenta. Right? So they're degenerate states, and therefore, even weak scattering will change their energies, splitting them up. So you expect to find gaps along this edge and along that edge. And presumably, the highest splitting would be where the edges intersect at a corner. So you expect the, so this would be the minimum of the band, the lowest band. This will probably be the maximum, and there'll be subtle points over here. So there are points of high symmetry in the Brillouin zone. This is highly symmetric, and so it'll be a minimum. This is also quite symmetric because, or this one, because you have other Brillouin zones being attached here. So it's also highly symmetric. You expect to have a maximum here, maybe, or in higher Brillouin, in higher energy zones, you will have maybe a minimum here also. And here you might have a subtle point because this direction and that direction are not equivalent. So that's typically what happens, with some interesting exceptions. In graphene, which doesn't have a triangular lattice, but it has sort of two interpenetrating triangular lattices. Right? It's a honeycomb lattice. You could draw it like this. But the periodicity of this lattice is the same as that of a hexagonal or triangular lattice, because so you have sites of one type, which can be translated into each other. The sites of the other type cannot be translated into them, right? They're not related by a lattice translation, because this one has a vertical bond above it, and this one has a vertical bond below it. So there's no translation that will mix them. So this still has this translation vector and that translation vector. It's the same symmetry of translation as in the lattice. And you will have the same reciprocal space physics. The wonderful thing about graphene is it turns out that here you don't have the band splitting at all. It vanishes for some symmetry reasons. And so you've got bands touching here. And as you go away from this direction anywhere, the splitting appears. And so you end up with Dirac points around K and around K prime. You've got relativistic electrons there, so to speak, although their speed is not the speed of light. Okay. You also get gaps around the center, if you go to higher bands, just like over there, right? So here you have a band gap at the center of the Brillouin zone. And there's one interesting feature here. In the limit of weakly scattering electrons, the curvature of this band is given by what? What determines how fast it curls up? The mass, right? So the mass here is the electron mass. And you can see the curvature here can be much higher. Right? As long as you have a weak scattering potential that opens up a tiny little gap, so you have to switch quickly from a line with a finite slope to another line with the opposite slope. So you have to do it over a very short k distance. So there's a large curvature here, which corresponds to a small mass. So it turns out that in semiconductors, you can find very, very small electron masses, like 1/25th of the electron mass. And that's not because there are very strong renormalization effects or something like that. It's just because the mass is this curvature. It has nothing to do with the original mass at all. And so this small mass of 1/25th in germanium, silicon has similar numbers for certain bands. It's just because of these effects. It's fairly weak scattering producing gaps. Okay. So with these very simple considerations, we can get some understanding of band structures. If you now open the band structure of silicon, germanium, gallium arsenide, you should be able to make at least some sense of them. There will be some strange names given to various points in the reciprocal lattice space. The central point is called gamma, and then there are other points called X, L, K, which I don't remember actually. So which one is which? But these are just names. Questions? Yes.
What makes certain points maxima or minima on the lattice
set? So if you look here, right, we start with the picture of free bands, and we know that we had a minimum over here. Right? And then for this lowest band, we would have the maxima at the edge. And then the next band will have the minimum at the edge and then the maximum at the center. Right? So it'll be a similar consideration there. What you have to do is the same exercise. You plot a parabola, a paraboloid of revolution, plot the shifted ones, and then see where they touch. And there will be maybe a lifting of the degeneracy thanks to scattering and so on. Right? So it'll be a similar thing to that.
How is that related to the graph?
Well, so this is basically just this line. Right? This is our Brillouin zone. And we can plot the energy in this Brillouin zone. Likewise, if I do it, this is our Brillouin zone in two dimensions. And so we need to add the third dimension, which would be the energy. Right? And so the energy would depend on kx and ky in a parabolic way. So it would be a quadratic dependence. Right, so the lowest band would start, we'll have the bottom here, and it'll go up toward the edge. So the minimum would be at the bottom, and the maximum would be at this point because it's the farthest from the center. Right? So the energy here would be higher than the energy there, simply because momentum here is larger than the momentum there.
You said that these points with high curvature correspond to low masses. But if you turn up the mass of the electron, wouldn't you expect that energies are higher so that the lowest?
No. So the energy, remember, it's h bar squared k squared divided by 2m.
Oh.
We're talking the non-relativistic dispersion.
Right.
So high curvature means low mass.
You said the splitting between the splitting of the gap is 2 times the lambda n. Like, can you show it?
Yeah. So, so let's take this, and we have the intersection of two bands, right? So these two bands, let's say, have a very close energies. And then the splitting will affect them, right? The scattering will affect them. We can ignore the rest of the bands because we're doing degenerate perturbation theory now. These levels are awfully close. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just take that 2x2 block and write down what happens to the energy near point B over 2. So K is B over 2 plus little q. So when q is 0, then there's a splitting. And I want to know what happens close to that. Then my Hamiltonian would be this. Right, so it's going to be h bar squared over 2m. Times k, which is that, b squared over 4. Let's just put it, b over 2 plus q squared, lambda 1, lambda star 1. And for the other one, I have to take this and subtract b. Right, so I'll have minus b over 2 plus k plus q squared. Okay. So if you expand this, you will have h bar squared over 2m times b squared over 4 plus q squared plus b times q. And the other diagonal term would be similar except for minus sign in one place. So b squared over 4 plus q squared minus bq. lambda 1, lambda 1 star. Right, so you can take this matrix and disassemble it into various parts. One part will be proportional to the unit matrix. It's this part. And so that's just the overall position of the energy level. So it's h bar squared over 2m times b squared over 4 plus q squared. And then the rest would be some non-trivial matrix. So that's h bar squared bq over 2m on the diagonal, h bar squared bq over 2m with a minus sign, and then lambda 1 and lambda 1 star. Right. So we can calculate the eigenvalues of this matrix. It's a superposition of the sigma 3 Pauli matrix, sigma 1, and sigma 2. Right. So you can determine that the energy would be that constant part, h bar squared over 2m, times b squared over 4, plus q squared, and then plus or minus the square root of the rest, right? So it's lambda 1 squared plus h bar squared bq over 2m squared. So at q equal to 0, you do get the splitting of one level goes up by lambda 1, the other goes down by lambda 1, and the splitting is twice lambda 1. Right? So that's the splitting. And you can also determine the curvature by expanding the square root and powers of q, and you'll have something that will have q squared divided by lambda 1. The smaller lambda 1 will be, the higher the curvature, the lower the new mass. So you can, if you expand this, then what you'll find is so E would be, so first, you know, there will be contributions that depend on Q, right? And I'm interested in the Q squared parts. So it will be H bar squared over 2m times Q squared, and that would be the original mass. But then you have to expand this, and that would be h to the fourth b squared q squared divided by 8m squared times lambda 1. Right. So if you just factor out h bar squared q squared over 2m, it's 1 plus h bar squared b squared divided by 4m lambda 1 or something like that. Right, so if lambda 1 is a small number compared to the kinetic energy of the electron, b squared over m is the kinetic energy of the electron, then this mass is going to decrease by a large factor. OK, we finished early today. Let's have lunch.